seems that the news comes at us faster than ever these days, and 2017 has been no exception. Today on the West Side, we're going to unpack some of the top local, regional, state, and national news stories of 2017 with local reporters and editors from Western Wisconsin. But first, we'll hear from a candidate running for a special election in far western Wisconsin. The race is for the 10th State Senate District, which is became wide open last month when longtime Republican State Senator Sheila Harsdorf resigned her seat in order to lead the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We sat down with a Libertarian candidate in that race. Tomorrow, voters in the 10th State Senate District will go to the polls for a special primary election to determine the finalist who will compete in January to replace longtime Republican State Senator Sheila Harsdorf. There are six candidates, three of them Democrats, two Republicans, and one Libertarian. Because of the unusually short time frame in this election, and since we've already featured the Democrats and Republicans in this race, we wanted to give our listeners a chance to hear from the Libertarian candidate. Joining me now is Brian Correa. He is the Libertarian candidate running for the 10th State Senate District seat. He hails from Wilson. Welcome to the West Side.
Thank you.
So, Brian, first of all, what spurred you to join this race, and why do you think that you're the right candidate to represent the 10th State Senate?
Well, you know, when they announced the opening of this seat, I thought the timing was a little odd, where holidays and everything else and the truncated schedule. It just really felt like there's a goal here to let's make sure that the Republicans can hang on to this seat. As a Libertarian, I look at it as an opportunity for voters to, I think, do something that they've always wanted to do, kind of give the voters a free pass to say, look, we're not fighting for the balance of the Senate here. We're replacing one seat. This is a great opportunity for voters to do something they've always wanted to do, and that is vote for a third-party candidate and to hear a fresh new voice in Madison. And as far as the 10th District is concerned, I think we have a very large – our district's huge, you know, from River Falls all the way up north and out to Menominee.
Yeah.
And it's a very diverse group. And so I think – well, I know that it's not represented by only two opinions. So I want to give the voters an opportunity to vote for a third-party candidate.
So – it's not represented by just two. That makes a lot of sense. Then what differentiates you from those two voices? I mean, what makes you different?
Well, there's two very specific. The two voices that are represented are on the Democrat side you have a party that likes to their tax and spend party. They believe in the heavy hand of government, but on the other hand, they are also socially liberal. They support civil liberties and things of that nature. On the other side, you have a fiscally conservative, although I don't know that I would call our current Republican leadership fiscally conservative, but they clamor towards fiscal conservatism, but then they also have an issue regarding civil liberties and some of the social issues. So as a Libertarian, I am a fiscal conservative, and I think that there's a broad appeal for that in our district, but I'm also socially liberal, and I think most people, if you talk to them, are social liberal. They fall into that category of being, they want a more financially responsible government, but they also want government to stay out of our personal life.
You mentioned fiscal responsibility and the party that claims to follow or adhere to those values. I was wondering what your thoughts are on the Foxconn development. $3 billion, I think, is the tally of taxpayer dollars going to this company from Taiwan for the promise of up to 13,000 jobs. Governor Walker was in Eau Claire recently, said that it would be 22,000 with all the spillover. Would you have supported that if you had a vote on it?
Absolutely not. The Foxconn deal isn't good for, first and foremost, that's not the proper role of government. When we talk about being a small government conservative or fiscal conservatism, it is not the role of government to hand out taxpayer money to pick and choose favorites and to give special favors to business. That's how corruption happens. That's why money flows into the capital. So that right out of the gate, it's just not the proper role of government to be doing those kinds of things. But second, we're looking at a 20 to 25 year return on investment from Foxconn. I mean, those are the estimates. That's not a good investment. We're talking about a plant that's going to be putting together television sets. Do we believe that 20 to 25 years from now, even 10 years from now, that we're still going to be paying humans to put together television sets? If you look at the press clippings on Foxconn, aside from their terrible environmental and human rights record, this is a company that's being very aggressive about automating their plants all throughout Asia. It seems hard for me to believe that that's not going to be a fate that we're going to suffer here in Wisconsin.
Another thing that's in the news recently goes back to taxes and taxpayers is the school funding formula. There are some hearings on that lawmakers are having on how to change it, how to tweak it. We've heard for decades that that it's unfair for rural school districts. We've got a lot of those in the 10th Senate District. I'm wondering, how would a Libertarian candidate, and I don't mean to say that everything has to go through that lens, but how would you, as a Libertarian candidate, approach the school funding formula?
Education is one of my top priorities. And I know everybody says that. That's what you hear all the time. But over and over again, nothing changes. You know, I went to a rural school in Mondovi, Wisconsin, and my son goes to a school down in Spring Valley. There isn't a lot of opportunity in the rural communities for them to take STEM courses, for example, or even advanced art courses and things of that nature. So there is limited opportunity in the rural communities. As a Libertarian, I support a more free market approach to education. I think that if we allow competition to enter the marketplace through a voucher system, that it's going to create opportunities that we wouldn't otherwise have. We want diversity of education for our kids. We want to be able to tailor education to get the most out of our kids. Well, we can't do that with a one-size-fits-all educational system.
Charter schools are pretty controversial when it comes to people that are. They will often say that it's kind of a battle between public dollars going to public schools, public dollars going to charter schools. Some Democrats, some liberals have said that it's the creation of a different school system. So would you take it to any extreme and channel more or all the money towards the charter schools and thereby kind of eliminating the traditional public school model?
No, absolutely not. There are great public schools out there, and there's a lot of fear, and that's understandable. There's a lot of misinformation, but first, in a lot of the places where they're piloting these programs in other states, the state money follows the student, but the district money oftentimes stays behind in that public school. So what you end up with is a student leaving a school to go to a charter school or to go to a private school with his voucher. He's taking a portion of the money that would have gone to that public school and leaving a portion of it behind. And what ends up happening is a lot of these public schools actually end up with more money per capita per student after a voucher system is introduced. So, no, I would absolutely support continuing public education. But at the end of the day, we know that competition makes things better. There's not another place in the market, there's not another service that we go out and utilize where we say, this would be a lot better if there was only one option. Competition makes things better. It'll make public schools better, and it'll create better educational opportunities for our kids.
One of the Republican candidates, State Representative Adam Jarko of Balsam Lake, has made a lot of news for some of the legislation that he's introduced. One of the bills that he worked with State Senator Tom Tiffany of Hazelhurst on is what's called the Homeowner Bill of Rights. And he's been a big champion, Adam Jarko, that is, for trying to reduce the hand of government on private property in how a person can develop their lots, in how shoreland zoning is administered, whether it's by the state or by local government. Some have said that some of his bills take away local control. Do you agree with that, or what's your approach to the property rights versus the neighbors or the local government's concerns?
I think we have to be very careful of two things. First, we have to be very careful about any movement of power or control from local to state. It's a trap that both parties tend to fall into when they happen to be the party in power. When one party is in power, they seem to be very anxious to move power away from local control into the state house or to Washington, D.C., because they happen to be in power. And then there's a lot of regret when they are no longer in power. Local control and local zoning protects people from those future issues. Or the other side of it is property rights are paramount. And so when we're looking at restrictive regulations and preventing people from being able to do things, we have to make sure we're asking ourselves is this an aesthetic issue or is this an environmentally harmful issue? You know, when it comes to environmentally harmful issues, dumping in the lakes and things of that nature, obviously we need to be cognizant of preserving our natural resources. But we also have to make sure that we're respecting people's property rights and their decisions on how they want to live on their property.
And one of the other issues that's been really tragic in the 10th Senate District and also across the state is opioids and addiction and overdose deaths. I remember for a span there was something like 5 or 6 overdose deaths in the River Falls area alone. And so a lot of legislation has happened, but people wonder if there's still more to be done. The 10th State Senate District, the Narcan, the overdose reversal drug, has been more available to first responders. The lawmakers recently passed a ban on fentanyl. Libertarian candidates are known as having kind of a hands-off approach for when it comes to drugs. So I was wondering, what's your thought on this opioid epidemic? What role does the state play, and should lawmakers be doing more to try to stop these deaths?
We need to understand why we have an opioid epidemic. We need to understand where this problem is coming from. And it's coming from overprescription. We prescribe opioids at such a high rate here that, and we don't think about the long-term consequences of that. And I don't understand why it's so simple to prescribe opioid medication, but we're so resistant to any other form of pain relief. For example, cannabis-based pain relief, where you don't have the addictive properties and you don't have the overdose risk. But, you know, a lot of these overdoses, this isn't just people, you know, using a needle or smoking. This is prescription medication overdoses that we're talking about in many cases. So we have to set aside some of our preconceived notions and free up the market to allow some alternatives to take over the marketplace when it comes to pain medication and pain relief. The other side of this is that we have a massive budget when it comes to imprisoning people, where we're getting ready to break a record in Wisconsin for the size of our prison population, with a third of those prisoners being nonviolent offenders. We need to make sure that we're looking at why these people are in prison, and is that the right path, or should we be moving some of these people into treatment? Treatment is much more effective and costs the taxpayer a lot less money. We're spending $33,000 per year for every nonviolent offender in jail, and at our current prison population, conservative estimates put that at over $200 million a year. That's money that could be redirected into treatment and additional funds for our law enforcement and additional resources freed up to go after more serious crime.
Brian Correa of Wilson is a Libertarian running for the 10th State Senate District seat. Brian Correa, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Brian Correa. A reminder, the 10th State Senate District, there is a primary election tomorrow. Partisan primary in the 10th State Senate District. There are 6 candidates that will be winnowed down to 3. January 8th, right here on the west side, we're going to feature the winners of the primary and Mr. Correa. And that'll be your second chance to ask direct questions, call in with your questions and comments for the candidates. Right now, we're going to take our break, and we'll be right back to talk about the top news stories of 2017. I've got 2 local reporters that are champing at the bit. Jesse Horn is going to join us, and Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson of the Leader Telegram, Jesse Horn of WEAU TV. If you've got a question or a comment, or if you want to share what you thought the top news story, whether it's local, regional, national, give us a call and let us know. 1-800-228-5615. Phone lines are wide open.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like DuPaco Credit Union and Sprinkman Real Estate play a huge role in the success of WPR. Become a business sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor.
It's called Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over. Area law enforcement agencies will patrol in greater numbers and for longer hours between now and January 1st. Taverns and restaurants have programs that provide a safe ride home. Visit online at tlw.org and click on Safe Ride.
I'm Rich Kramer. You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in on Ideas 88.3 WHWC and 88.7 WRFW. For the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about the top news stories of 2017 as reported by people in western Wisconsin and, of course, the national and state media as well.
Joining me in the studio, I've got two local reporters. I've got an editor and a reporter. Gary Johnson is the editor of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. Gary Johnson, welcome to the program.
Morning, Rich.
Seems like it's been a year since we've
just
talked.
About, yes.
Just about. And also joining us in the studio is Jesse Horn. He is a reporter, anchor, and multimedia journalist at WEAU-TV. Jesse Horn, welcome to the show.
Good morning. I think it's been about a week since I saw you last.
Yes.
We've been hitting the trail a lot lately.
We have. Governor Walker, the Democratic candidates, and we'll probably run into each other.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. And, of course, the year is not over, but I wanted to ask both of you. I'll start with you, Jesse Horn. As far as let's look locally. Let's kind of cast the net a little local at first. What do you think the top news story for the region was 2017?
Gosh, there was so much. I mean, and honestly, and this is kind of the whole of this, which for me is a lot of the issues that really came down to 2017 were the issues that just cut through the fluff. They cut through all the stuff that just the noise that you would hear from other places. We'll just kind of leave it at that. But my first one was the tornado up in northern Wisconsin that hit Barron and Rusk counties. One dead, 25 injured, and just left so much devastation. I think that was a case where it didn't matter what if you were a Republican or a Democrat. It didn't matter if you were libertarian, socialist, whatever. That gets thrown out the window. These were people. These were people that were affected. This massive, you know, force of Mother Nature hits. And they're still rebuilding up there. We've just recently, my colleague Amanda Tyler did a story about 6 months afterwards, and they're still trying to pick up, especially at that trailer park that really took the brunt. And I think that that's probably, in my mind, the biggest human interest, one of the biggest human interest stories and had one of the biggest impacts locally, definitely.
Yeah, a couple stats that I dug up thinking that we would bring this up, because that was my pick, too. After all was said and done, I think the Weather Service said that it was an EF3, which is pretty powerful. 140-mile-an-hour winds. It was on the ground for 83 miles, so that was a record, I think.
And that was the thing, too, is that we focused a lot on Barron County, and obviously so. That was where more of the injuries and the one fatality was. But it stretched from even just before it crossed into Barron County in through Rusk County, and that was the night it hit. I was up with Bob Gallagher. We were up in town of Conrath, just south of Ladysmith,
yeah,
where there was massive devastation down there, and then continued on. It was the path was so long. I had never, I'm from here, born and raised. I had never heard of a tornado being that powerful for that long of a time.
Absolutely, Gary Johnson, your thoughts on what was one of the top stories from your perspective, anyway, of 2017?
Well, certainly Chautauqua was as well. We had reporters up there. I mean, just look at the photos. I mean, like you said, months later, it's devastating. But you know, out of that, you know, I think you can see where the community comes together, though.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that some of the as tragic as it was, the really good stories came out of these local organizations that all came together. I mean, every Saturday you'd see this call out, well, we're having cleanup again at the trailer park this weekend, and people would just come out and help each other. I mean, it didn't matter if they knew each other. You know, and to make it a little more tragic, if you recall, a few weeks later there was the plane crash where the high school student who had been pretty integral part of helping getting his football team and other high school kids together to help the cleanup, he dies in a plane crash, too.
Yeah,
so, I mean,
his buddy survives. Hunter Gillette survives. He's a student over at Stout right now.
Yeah, so they, I mean, Chautauqua just really had a really tough year. But I think, you know, we've talked to Chris Fitzgerald, the sheriff up there, many times, you know, and it's just like, you know, they stay upbeat. It's like, you know, it's been a really tough year, but, you know, the community has really pulled together. So it's you know, some good came out of the bad.
I'll say that this was my first disaster kind of coverage that I did, and I was there the day that the governor visited. It was pretty crazy. You know, I've probably got a distorted view because what I was noticing a lot, aside from the devastation and all the positivity that was being expressed by the people that lived through that, I was also noticing all the national media, you know, that's kind of buzzing around. But it was my first time ever walking through something like that, and it was just devastating. But at the same time, you heard the chainsaws, you heard the beeps of the trucks backing up, the tractors and the front end loaders.
You also, I mean, it was, you know, even though, you know, kind of as far as natural disasters goes, as kind of a second tier one was the flooding down in Arcadia.
Sure.
That they got hit. And you talk about, you mentioned Governor Walker being on the ground in up in Barron County. He was also as well, too. I was there when he toured that area as well, too. So I think this area really just kind of hit got hit by Mother Nature really worse than I've seen in previous years. Mm-hmm. But as you said, Gary, that the community really kind of came together wherever it was, whether it was Arcadia up in Rice Lake, and we come together as human beings when we need to, and we definitely probably should do it more often.
Yeah, the silver lining. I mean, that's definitely the silver lining in that story. It's really nice to see people just drop all the fronts, you know. 1-800-228-5615. I'm speaking with Gary Johnson of the Leader Telegram and Jesse Horn of WEAU-TV about the top stories of 2017. The year is not over, and there could easily be more news, but...
Scare me like that.
We've got some holidays coming up, so we felt like we needed to get this program, you know, on the air.
Sure.
Before the end of the year. So 1-800-228-5615. And during a break, Gary, you mentioned something that I totally spaced, even though it is one of the biggest stories that happened around here, and that was the Gordy's. So
yeah, the Gordy's market story, excuse me, for many people, I mean, that was probably the biggest thing that happened to them when you talk about a variety of communities. I mean, the small towns, you know, from Whitehall, Chautauqua, and Rice Lake, and Eau Claire. You know, this is a company that had 26 stores, and they were everywhere. You know, people, you know, they're very, the philanthropers, they give a lot to the community and stuff. And then this great business, and suddenly things started, the food was missing from shelves, and people mm-hmm. say, what's up with Gordy's? And then it starts coming, and obviously there were financial problems. You know, they overextended, you know, themselves too much and started... You know, stores were getting sold, and in the court system, I mean, this is, you talk about ground level, you know, basic level. People want to be able to walk down to the grocery store and buy food, and suddenly some of these small towns especially, they just couldn't do it anymore.
And it was a little tough from the making the sausage perspective, because there wasn't a lot of information coming out from the family. We basically had to pick up the pieces, Jesse Horn, from court documents and the trials.
Yeah, court documents, and just as you said, picking out the pieces. But also, I think the pieces of trouble were probably showing itself long before we started seeing the lawsuits. I mean, I'll give you an example. 2 years ago, going into New Year's, I actually flew out to New York City New Year's Day, 2016. I was going to see a friend of mine. So I had an early morning flight, and my payment to her was basically bring some cheese curds. Yep. So I stopped at, it was 3 a.m. because I had a ground shuttle from here to the Twin Cities and then to New York. And it was 3 a.m., but I could still swing into the East Hamilton Avenue Gordy's because they were open at 3 a.m. Well, then when they stopped being open overnight, they weren't 24 hours anymore.
Yeah.
That was kind of like the first sign of, they're kind of cutting back on hours. They can't staff as much. That kind of was the first domino, at least in my mind, the first domino. And then when you started hearing that, you know, we were hearing, you know, reports that some stores couldn't even put sugar on the shelf, that's not good. So yeah. I think now we've kind of hit this point of there is some finality to this with now Festival in place and two other locations in Eau Claire. I think the big places that are going to be really hit hard are going to be the smaller communities, right, like Stanley, like those places that really only had the one grocery store, and that was it. So now that they're gone, Stanley's an example. I was looking it up, and they shut down permanently. Now those people have to probably drive to maybe Cadott at the closest, but for, you know, even the Lake Wissota connection, Gordy's is still open. That's like another 25, 30 miles away. That's tough for these communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, the drama is not over. I don't know if you call it drama, but this whole receivership, first of all, I don't know if any of you went to school to get your law degree in bankruptcy law or whatnot.
I can't even do simple addition some days. So
it's really tough reading through those documents to try to get any sense of it. But now there's discussion that it looks like the sale went through, right?
Yes.
The Gordy's family, or at least some of the family members.
They will keep six stores, yes.
Which stores?
The ones in like downtown Chippewa, yep.
the Lake Wissota. For sure. That never shut down, did it?
No, they never shut down. And honestly, I think that's important because, as you were saying, this is a family that's been around for a long time.
Yeah.
Gordy's stores have been around since I was a little shaver here. I mean, that name is synonymous with with local grocery. That at the very least, if they're keeping those core stores open, especially the one downtown Chippewa, you know, I think it was the old Red Owl.
Going back to basics.
Yeah,
is what they
back
said.
To basics. And I think that's very important. They can kind of just bring it back down to ground level and start up. And that's, I think that at least there is a good silver lining in that.
They did what they did pretty well for a long time until it got too large, apparently. You know, so I mean, I like the fact that they want to keep their Chippewa stores because they're still considered Chippewa. You know, they did keep some of the outlying ones a little bit as well. But I think they can probably make a go of this now.
Right. And, of course, we've got it in Eau Claire anyway, the two Gordy's locations, two of the three locations that were in the city. Or were there more?
No, you had three. Because
right.
You had the one over just down from our studios here on Claremont.
Claremont, yeah.
And, I'll take it back. You had four.
The Shopko Plaza.
Shopko Plaza. You had East Hamilton. You had the one on Birch Street.
Right.
And then you had the one on North Claremont. So you had four there. Now you're down to, the North Claremont, Birch Street, and now those are festival foods.
Right.
East Hamilton is, nothing's there. I was driving by there yesterday. I didn't see anything. And now we're, you know, there's still the one over here on Claremont.
Other than the festival takeover, which is a company that at least people in Eau Claire are used to, what do we know about any of the companies that are taking over? Do we know anything about the companies that are looking to purchase and operate the others?
Not a lot. I mean, I know there's an Iowa-based company involved and some others.
Something from Michigan down
right.
in the Acadia area.
Right. I mean, you're right. Festival's pretty well known, but that's really the only one. And I think this West Side store, the festival taking over that, is pretty huge for the West Side there.
Yes.
They were just, they couldn't wait
right.
until that got taken over again. That's a huge expanding area on the West Side, and suddenly they went from having this nice-sized grocery store to nothing, driving all the way across town to get to anything.
And
right.
and then the other one, which is on Birch Street, I put that as basically a direct, for them getting, first of all, getting that one, a direct challenge to Woodman's. Right down there with Woodman's, basically. It was one thing when Festival came on in, but when Woodman's came on in right there at River Prairie, that took a lot of hits as far as other stores around here.
I would think so.
And so now that they're going to open it, they've opened it back up over there for the last couple of weeks, I think with them being 24/7 just down the street, that's going to be that, in a sense, challenge if they can with Woodman's.
And Festival's gone head-to-head with Woodman's before in other communities.
Sure.
You know, down in La Crosse area, they do. So I think they decided, well, yeah, we'll take this. But you got to think that West Side store was really attractive for them.
Huge.
Well, and there's large groups. I mean, it's near some areas. Both of those stores, Birch and the Western, the one on Claremont or North Claremont, there's probably people there that don't have the option to just drive wherever they want to get the groceries. So that's a big thing for them. I mean, I don't know if it qualified as a food desert over on the West Side, but without the grocery store. But where I live down by the Oxford Theater, and you know they've been talking about trying to get a grocery store downtown where the post office is now. But that's definitely, I see people filling carts at Quick Trip, which is unfortunate. But anyway. 1-800-228-5615. If you have a story that you think rises above the rest, either at the local, regional, state, or national level, we're talking about the top news stories of 2017 with Jesse Horn. He is a reporter and anchor and a multimedia journalist at WEAU-TV, and Gary Johnson is the editor of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. 1-800-228-5615. I just wanted to talk a little bit about development, and I don't want to. I want to try to branch out, of course, but it's easy to focus on the stuff that you see and hear about all the time. But holy moly, Prairie River Drive, River Prairie, the development that's happened in Altoona, that part of Altoona, and in Eau Claire has been just bananas, don't you think?
It's been nuts to see, and I say it positive because there's been a lot of development that's happened around there. It's been kind of, I would almost put it as a crown jewel for the area, for the metro. But what it also shows is that you're seeing also that spill over into other areas. You mentioned where you are, Rich. That whole area there was part of that, what they want to call the Cannery District.
Yep.
And the city really was trying to put that as being kind of the next feeder program as it is. I think this year, which was one of the big things, the back and forth, which has mostly been now finalized between the Brewing Project and the Redevelopment Authority, to finally have that set down. Now they're going to be able to start moving in and start working in there. I think that was talking we reported on probably early part of next year. Is that when
they're working
down there?
Yeah.
So and I remember when we covered the the meeting that they had with the RDA, and it was said then that this will be, in a sense, that like fixture, that first fixture for the district, and then once that's in place, that'll hopefully start the dominoes to then clean that whole area up, bring in some more developments, and really do it. The trail now is open along the river from the High Bridge down to Madison Street, and hopefully kind of get now the buzz going. And I think it might be the next area now, and the city's really looking to try and do that.
Yeah, it's an exciting thing, but also, you know, living in that area, I kind of wonder what'll happen to a lot of these people. I mean, it's not a high-income area, and the rents are pretty low in that area, which is what attracted me to it. But so I can't help but wonder, is this going to drive people out? Because at one point down in the river, the Phoenix Park area, that whole area had a lot of people that lived there were kind of driven out because rent is now well over $800 a month there, I would imagine. Gary Johnson, any thoughts on the battle royale between Will Glass and the RDA?
That was an interesting. We covered that a lot. I mean, Will's not scared to say what he thinks, you know, which we obviously like in the media.
We love it.
You know, but you know, recently had a mural that the city doesn't like, and they find him for it. But I mean, yeah, we've been told that, you know, potentially, you know, January even they may start at the new building. To talk about River Prairie and the Cannery District, I think it's interesting that the trails were such an important part. You know, I think especially River Prairie, you look at the green space and how Altoona really incorporated the park-like setting and the trail along the river. I mean, anybody that goes down there, I mean, it looks like a park.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got the condos there. You've got everything. I mean, it's kind of its own self-sustaining little area there. You know, if there was a grocery store down there, I mean, you would have everything there where you would just have to walk to restaurants to get your hair cut, to go out to eat, to go to the park. I mean, I think you're seeing things change here a little bit. And I think the Cannery District as well. I think you'll see. That's why that trail the city felt that was really important to get that trail through there.
Yeah.
Because it brings people through there and they're saying, oh, what may be, you know?
Absolutely.
They get some ideas.
And I love that it connects. I mean, I took my bike up the thing and it's still a pretty steep climb, but I took a trip down the trail up to the High Bridge and then over to the other side across the river by the paper plant, and it's nice. It's very nice.
But one thing I think that comes out of this is that, as Gary was saying, is that these are areas where you want to basically have all like one-stop shop for everything. When these areas are now growing, they're all molding together. It's not just Eau Claire. It's Eau Claire, right. Altoona, Lake Halley has now just blossomed as well, too, into Chippewa. In my mind, it's almost one unit, the entire Eau Claire, Chippewa Falls, Altoona metro area. And I think that's where a case comes down to now is we still have to kind of get to these areas. And I think I would wonder how much more there is going to be that cross travel that's going to be now increasing. But you don't have much more to go. But I was talking about this, which was, there's now a bus line that goes into Altoona, I believe. It's been going. How long has it been going out for?
It's been a while, yeah.
Been a while, but I remember when there was one in Chippewa. You can take the bus to go up to Chippewa, and I would wonder now.
Oh.
I remember when I was a kid, there was still a transit line that would go up there. I wonder if maybe 5 years down the road, if the growth continues and it really starts molding together, if there would still be that sense of really kind of bringing the whole together, or if there's still going to be that independence to say, no, we're Chippewa, no, we're Eau Claire, but as the years go by, and this year especially, it's becoming more blurred as far as the lines go in there.
I wonder if we'll go back to the old electric railway, right? Didn't they not have something that I'm on one of these Our Old Town Eau Claire Facebook pages. I love it, by the way. But a lot of pictures of the trolley, basically, that would go from, I think, Altoona to Eau Claire.
Well, one of the other things was the Mills Fleet Farm. The distribution center is in Chippewa.
Huge.
But they're building a store on the south side of Eau Claire.
Yeah. Yep.
Now, so I think, you know, they're looking, these companies are looking all around at the communities as like the Chippewa Valley.
Well, how many times have you all been reading something online that are where they start pointing to Eau Claire as like the way to make growth happen in Wisconsin? I mean, not just the arts, but just in general. I mean, the arts seems to be a big part of that. I mean, how big do you think, and we've got the 10 years or 20 years for the Justin Vernon, the Bon Iver album, that he's going to be playing a concert in Milwaukee in February. So now people are saying, well, how much of an impact did that and did him and the other Young Money that we're putting, investing back into the community?
I think that the thing is, the arts have been great. I mean, I left here in 99. I kind of hopscotched around other places, came back here 2 years ago, and was amazed by all that. I think now, though, is the fact that, yes, you have all these cool things. You have the Oakland Music Festival. You have all these other things going on. Well, this is not just a good fun place to visit. It's also a fun place to live. Mm-hmm. And I think now we're basically trying to see, where are those good jobs? I think we're starting to finally take off the shackles of the Unirail shutdown in the early 90s.
Sure.
It took about 20 plus years to get past that. Now that Eau Claire and the area has shaken that off, you're starting to see more of a different economy, a more vibrant economy, and it's starting to kind of get itself back in there that it really wasn't even 10 years ago.
That's like the next problem, though. We had a story yesterday on the front page about the lack of bodies. I mean, it used to be, you know, there was a skills gap where you didn't have certain types of workers, but now it's just no workers. I mean, you're talking, you know, less than 3% unemployment. I mean, these companies, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, they say, they hear from everybody. They can't talk to an employer that doesn't say, I need people. I need people to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's just, that's a concern in this community.
And that's what we had a couple stories about that, and I had one where we talked about those, you know, hard-to-fill positions. And around here that Wisconsin, that the jobs was talking about. And we focus on the trucking industry because it's one of those, it's hard to fill positions. And that's a case where we want to get people now, but it's really trying to get people to even stay with those positions. So, yeah. I think we're starting to kind of now, it's like we need to take care of the job situation and really kind of hammer that down.
With that, we've got our first caller of the morning. And if you want to call in with your thoughts on what the top news stories for 2017 were, let us know, 1-800-228-5615. Willem in Colfax, you're on the air. What's up, Willem?
Hi. There was a story about this, what's called the Albertville Valley Mine. It's a 1,300-acre proposed sand mine in the town of Howard. And one of the things that happened with that is in August, there was a lawsuit filed. And it seems like I haven't heard much coverage of that other than outside of Leon Ralph's excellent coverage in the Colfax Messenger. I haven't heard much on television news or the news about the problems with that mine, the improper filling of boreholes, and this lawsuit. It seems like it's a story that hasn't really been covered. And I'm wondering if you're aware of it and why it hasn't been covered.
Thanks for that, Willem. And I'll be honest, I have not been aware of that one. Jesse?
I can speak to a little bit about that because we, a while back, I'm trying to call it up here as I'm actually doing this. I did a report. There was a town hall regarding a mine situation where they were trying to connect those pipelines. Sorry, not mines. We've had some stuff with sand mines around the area. And forgive me, I was kind of confusing this with
the pipelines.
The pipelines.
Yeah,
and I know that's where it comes down to. I think that's where you see now these areas that, again, it's all politics is local. Well, you know, this is where a case this year where these stories really hit the local on this. And I think when we, as I always say, is why we haven't heard about it. Well, that's the first I'm hearing about it. And that's fantastic for we're hearing about it. And I will be starting
Same
to look
here.
At this as well, too. So
I definitely will as well. And, you know, when the sand mining boom happened, I think it was like 2012, 2013, 2014. It was like, that was the bread and butter. This is most of what I covered was going to town hall meetings, whether it's zoning, you know, permit, some kind of permit meetings. And then, of course, it died down. I think it was 15 in 2016 because the oil prices kind of crashed out. But as far as I know, it's coming back. I just read some news about a merger. Preferred Sands and Uniman is merging up, and there's some other stories that will be coming, I promise. 1-800-228-5615. If you've got a question or a comment, we've got Jesse Horn of WEAU-TV in the studio with us and Gary Johnson of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. Actually, let's take a break here. 1-800-228-5615. We've got about 15 minutes to talk about the top news stories of 2017. We have not even begun to scratch the surface, so stay tuned.
The media industry is changing fast with massive mergers and a regulatory rollback by the FCC. They raise concerns over conflicts of interest and the integrity of the internet. Those in favor of the changes point to a better user experience. But wait, we're the users. What does all this mean for us? I'm Joshua Johnson. That's next time on 1A from WAMU and NPR. Join me this afternoon at 1 here on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Alumni Association, dedicated to providing student aid and attracting new scholars through the University of Wisconsin's annual campaign. More at supportuw.org. Support for WPR comes from UW Credit Union, dedicated to providing a variety of investment options paired with financial consultants members can trust. More at uwcu.org. Your best interest always comes first. Wisconsin Public Radio's website is made for your mobile phone. Read the news from the state and the world, and listen to our streams. It's all formatted for your mobile phone or tablet. Stay on top of the news at WPR.org.
You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. I'm Rich Kramer, and joined by Gary Johnson, editor of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, and Jesse Horn, reporter, anchor, multimedia journalist at WEAU-TV in Eau Claire. We're talking about the top news stories of 2017, and we would love to hear from our listeners. Give us a call and let us know what you thought the top news story was. If you want to bring something else up, please do. We've got a caller right now in Eau Claire, and Lynn, we're going to you. Lynn in Eau Claire, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Rich. Accountability yes. is on my mind. There was a specific story earlier this year. It was reported in the newspapers and also on television. It had to do with a purported drug ring. And there were allegations made that were absolutely untrue, not in the papers of discovery, and no one's made a retraction. And the man who was specifically targeted lost his job, his wife, his kids, and on and on and on. And the facts were ignored, but the report still came out, and it was false. And we have to have accountability somewhere.
Did this have to do with the Cadott Medical Center that you're talking about, or no?
No.
Oh, okay. No. Jesse Horn.
Ma'am, let me just ask you, I guess, educate us. I mean, there's so many of these cases.
It was Blake Hendrick. Blake Hendrick.
I don't know specifics off the top of my head, so forgive me here as far as this case goes. I will speak to this. One of my roles in my job is I go through every day criminal complaints. So we go through and look at the criminal complaints, and we scour those criminal complaints with a fine-tooth comb. So when we do our reporting, we'll say, according to a criminal complaint filed by Eau Claire County District Attorney's Office or Chippewa County, whatever it is, we say that because if it's reported in that, we report it. So I guess that's where, I guess I'm speaking in general about our reporting on it. We make sure on that because that's where we get our information. And I've always said is if there is and I'll speak to another case that I said this too, which was, if there is an error in the reporting on that, then I would say, well, here's what it says in the criminal complaint. If there is an error in the criminal complaint, I would suggest calling the district attorney's office and saying what you have in the criminal complaint is incorrect. And if they decide to retract, then yes, then we say.
That's not the issue. The issue is I have seen the discovery papers and what was alleged is nowhere in there.
What do you mean by discovery papers?
Like during the trial, right? Is that what you're talking about, Lynn?
Thank you, Rich. Yes.
All right. Well, without knowing much of the details, Lynn, we appreciate it. I'm going to transition here and talk about news accountability. Lynn, thank you for your call. Sorry we don't have more information about it, but if you want to, you can check out, send something to the Facebook page, and we can try to double back on it.
And I guess we can, Gary here, is that's been a big overall issue for us, is that whenever it's been said as far as what's been done as far as other people's actions or comments regarding the media or other like outlets, national outlets, it does trickle back to us at the local level. And we definitely, I'll say this year, have been probably having to be more on guard and more careful with our reporting on everyday activities because of, just, again, that accountability. There are more questions of accountability that are brought to us, and we have to make sure about that. It doesn't necessarily change what I do, but it heightens our awareness, and I think that's a big
definitely
thing.
And you know, this era, I wanted to talk about the whole claim of fake news and all that, but we get things wrong. I mean, we are human, and a lot of times because of deadlines and whatever, I'm not trying to make excuses, but we make mistakes just like anyone else. We do our best to retract and all that. Again, without knowing, I can't remember that case specifically, but I wanted to ask both of you, and I'll start with Gary Johnson, about the whole fake news thing. I mean, we get complaints all the time, of course, and that's part of the job. We understand that. But this year, the term fake news seemed to, over the past year anyway, actually, a year in even 2016 during the election, fake news was a term that it wasn't created, but it certainly was right. Mainstreamed. Has that sort of thing kind of trickled back to...
I mean, there are certainly, there's two types of fake news, as they say. One is something is on the internet that's simply not, it's false. It's a made-up story.
Made to look like a...
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you look at the source and it's nothing you've heard of. You don't recognize that at all. And what's not fake news is what people claim is that if they simply don't agree with something,
yeah,
they don't agree, well, that's not a story, or... It's easy to say, well, fake news, but just it's the media doing their thing again. Well, that's not true. I mean, we're responsible. We report the news the best we have. Absolutely. We correct things when we get it wrong. I mean, people call us and say, hey, you got this name wrong, or you got this address, or this was not guilty instead of guilty. We'll correct that immediately. But if it's not wrong, just because you scream fake news, if it's not wrong, we're not going to correct it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's a very good point. Is that I think you throw that term around, it's like a frisbee. It's like it's out there so much, but then when it gets tossed out there, almost to the level of being just becoming cliche now, it's like I think the fake news it does hurt because we go every day, you know, busting our hump. And I mean, last I checked, I have flesh and blood, and I've got a brain up here. That we do our best, and that's where we try to basically do our best to get as much of the story right as possible. What I mean is much of the story right, and with our limitation in time, in as quick of a time as possible. And I know on Gary's side, as far as with the space that's involved, it's tough for us.
I mean, why would we make stuff up? That our credibility is everything to us. I mean, we're not just going to make up a story to make somebody look bad, obviously. That would get out. I mean, we're responsible journalists. We talk to reporters all the time, and let's make sure we get it right. If we didn't get it right, you make sure you correct it right away.
The you know, one of the things that can definitely trip us up though is that we rely on the information that we're given, whether it comes from an official source like a press release that turns out to be wrong, etc. And again, I'm not trying to make excuses, but it seems that people aren't. They don't quite know how the sausage is made, but anyhow, I wanted to. So, fake news. You know, the president used that term. President Donald Trump has used it quite a bit. Do you think he's helped mainstream the idea that all media or that a number of media organizations are out to get him, or do you think that local news kind of has some insulation from that?
You know, I think local news does have a little bit more of an insulation
people
because
trust it
because like. Like he said, you know, we're flesh and blood. We see people out in the community. We see people at the YMCA, at, you know, at church and places like that where we're real people.
Yeah.
It's not like something, you know, they won't see somebody from the Washington Post or the New York Times where, you know, the president will scream all that. They're just making all this up. Well, they're not making it up either. But I really do think that local readers, local viewers see us as being more responsible because we're out there and they see us out there and they've watched us and read us for years.
And to, you know, that point, because we are, in a sense, more of the boots on the ground, because we are the ones that have been right there and that we are there every single day, be it a byline, be it, you know, our voice or our faces on broadcast, I think because of that, we have to be more careful. We have to basically then raise our game. If people are just going to toss that or, you know, that label around, I think we have to basically raise our game and make darn sure that we have every T crossed and I dotted. And I think it's definitely been, it's waking me up to a little bit to say, hey, you know, any little slip on my part, it's going to be magnified tenfold than what it was 4 years ago.
Other than trying to be more careful in our work personally, have your organizations or what more can we do, I guess, to make sure that we prove that we're not that term?
Breathe. What I mean is, I think because we are so much getting it fast,
yeah.
We get a story. Sure, we want to beat our other station in town. Right. Sure, we want to get in before Gary and the and the LT does. At that time, though, I'd rather be right than just first.
Yeah.
And if we can, you know, sometimes we just have to take 10 seconds, think about it, process in our minds, and then go with it. Or ask other people and say, let's have the discussion before we get to that point. And I know over at Gary's newsroom, I'm sure you've had plenty of discussions when those stories are out there. Said, are we sure about this?
Right. Right. Yeah. All right. So we've got like 2 minutes left. I wanted to go national here. What do you think the top national news story was? I mean, again, there was a lot, but Gary Johnson, you first.
I think just the Trump presidency and everything that's happened.
How many inches in your paper has that subject gotten?
Well, you know, we try to think of ourselves as a local newspaper. We want our local news to be the primary, what you see in our newspaper. We cover it, but you know what? There's a lot of places to find out about Trump. Our newspaper, you'll find out, but locally, we really try to stress that more.
Jesse Horn, we've got less than a minute.
I'll kind of narrow it down from this, not that, but I say responses to some of these disasters we've had, the California wildfires, the hurricanes. I think bring it back to the first part of our discussion, which is it this year has humanized us, I think, a lot locally. And I think just seeing the response that's been there, and some would say lack of response in other cases, it's really kind of brought, you know, the news right to our heart and soul.
Thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining me. Jesse Horn is a reporter for WEAU-TV. Gary Johnson is editor of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. A big thanks to Brian Correa for speaking with me for the run-up to the 10th State Senate District election, which happens tomorrow. There's a primary election, excuse me. Also, thanks to Team Westside. Have a safe and productive holidays. We'll chat again January 8th.